Hey, it's Ron. This episode was recorded before I launched Politicology, when I hosted the Lincoln Project podcast on this feed. If you have questions, comments, or advice, you can reach us at podcast@politicology.com or find us online at politicology.com. Enjoy. Welcome back. I'm Ron Steslow. This episode is going to be different from the episodes you've heard so far. Every Friday, we're going to bring you a rotating panel to talk to you about the news you need to know, why it's important, and what it means for the Lincoln Project's mission to defeat Donald Trump this November. First up today, we're going to talk about Trump's speech in Tulsa. He's going to host his first rally in over 3 months tomorrow night. Well, it'll be today when you hear this episode. This comes in the middle of a coronavirus spike in Tulsa and across the country. And it's also in the middle of a national conversation about race after the death of George Floyd. Reed, let's start with you. Why is he having this rally this weekend? And why is he having it in Tulsa? What is the president thinking?
Well, I mean, look, I think it's clearly he's been bound up in the White House for several months, like everybody. And the rally has always been the clearest and loudest expression of who, like, the Donald Trump lizard brain really is. And so I think what you're seeing now is that, you know, he's way down in the polls across the country and in target states. And so, of course, he chose the perennial target state of Oklahoma in which to kick off his campaign. So I think that what you're seeing here is if I was going to use a metaphor, it would be like Trump is a steaming big orange boiler who is ready to just explode. And I think that they need to let some steam out here and let, you know, the Trump faithful sort of give him the energy back that he's probably been missing for the last few months. And so, this is, I think, purely a sop to his id, to his ego, and trying to make him feel like, he's not getting crushed everywhere, mostly because of his own decisions and indecisions and inaction across, you know, the various crises that we face as a country. And so I think that, you know, the Tulsa rally could be one for the ages. And I think if you have a VCR, you know, set it to record for whenever this thing goes off on Saturday night.
I don't know if you guys have seen some of the pictures already that are popping out around Tulsa, but it looks like a combination of the Mos Eisley Cantina and a Confederate encampment right outside of the area. They're lined up for miles and for Super Spreaderpalooza 2020.
It's just going to be a moment of peak craziness, and it's going to usher in this, you know, roughly 150-day period where it's just going to be nuts in the country. And I think you're going to see peak insanity. The people that are going to it, I think it's just unimaginable that there's not going to be some uptick from COVID as a result of this in Oklahoma. And, after months of failure at an extraordinary and epic level for the country over the coronavirus handling, over the shattered economy, he's going to get up there, he's going to lie, he's going to demagogue, he's going to race bait. He's going to feed red meat to the faithful. But I think after months of watching the consequences come due for this presidency, I think that normal people in this country, Republicans, Democrats, independents, are going to be sitting back at their, you know, in their homes watching this and say, holy shit, you know, we can't give this guy 4 more years. Just he's not capable of doing the job, I think, is what people are going to see this weekend.
Hey, Ron, you threw us a curveball, though, when you said, what's the president thinking? Into that. But if you pull the lens back and look at the electoral map and look at what's happened to the Trump campaign, where they've announced their rallies, they're going into a plus 10, plus 15 Republican state in Oklahoma, and they're going to follow through with rallies in Arizona, Texas, Florida, North Carolina, and then one dip into Alabama with a revenge rally against Jeff Sessions. It's morphed into the George Wallace Remembrance Tour, and he's bleeding all across the United States in states and within demographic groups. And they're doing this, I think Reed said this, to satisfy his ego or to get data so they can send more Facebook ads so, you know, the campaign manager can buy another Ferrari. But meanwhile, they're collapsing politically. And the more the president is doing this and not talking about rebuilding the economy accrues to Joe Biden's favor.
If you had to pick a rally, John, which one would you want to go to? I would be, for me, the Jeff Sessions revenge tour sounds like the one I would want to be at.
Yeah, going back to Mobile, to that high school football stadium where little Jeff endorsed him, a little revenge for a football coach, right? The Confederate flag flying, the South rising again. I think George Wallace would be proud of that.
Yeah, it's truly amazing that, you know, it's, you know, I mean, take the Alabama piece, right? I mean, it's just the idea that, I mean, you know, I'm an old advance man, right? Moving the leader of the free world is not a small thing. And the idea that you would pick up the entire presidential entourage with all of the staff and all of the Secret Service and all of the military and the airplanes that fly the cars in and the helicopters that come, specifically because you're still pissed off at your attorney general for actually doing the thing he was supposed to do, is a fascinating window like into the whole operation and how it is the, you know, we use the concept of the audience of one, as Rick calls it, when we do stuff about the president himself. And we should never forget the whole thing, his whole campaign, all 1800 staff and the $700 or $800 million they've already spent, which is an outrageous amount of money since he took office 3.5 years ago, is all aimed at propping up one old man's self-image.
I think it'd be great if he arrived by horseback to this thing, like Roy Moore did to the polls. It would be.
Well, is it a horse or is it a donkey?
Let's never forget that Trump endorsed Roy Moore. Let's never forget that. Yeah. That was a moment where you just had a window into this guy that he's bad at everything, including reading other people. But I have to tell you, I love the Jeff Sessions story so much for two reasons. One, you know, Tuberville's going to be a very exciting Miami Vice kind of candidate. And that's foreshadowing for the audience. And two, I mean, it's Jeff Sessions was the alpha patient of everything Trump touches dies. He went out there early on and he had so much credibility with conservatives. Oh, well, if Jeff Sessions is endorsing Trump, he must be right on all these things. If Jeff Sessions is out there, you know, he's a true, you know, constitutional economic liberty conservative. Well, it turns out it doesn't matter. he's going to have a bad couple of days, because when Trump gets down there, you know, he's going to be as juvenile and shitty as only Trump can be to this guy.
Yeah. And that's a good point too, that goes back to Tulsa, you know, and we'll see this as we go, is that, you know, Trump actually has a lot, there's probably a lot for him personally riding on his performance. Cause you know that some of these folks have been sitting in, you know, 105 degree humid Oklahoma heat for like 96 hours, right? They're sunburned, they're hot, they're thirsty. And if he doesn't bring the fire to them, it's gonna go over like a lead balloon. So, you know, I don't know if he takes, if he drinks 3 or 4 extra Diet Cokes and takes a couple of extra Adderall, but you should assume that, you know, every pre-program participant, whether or not it's Don Jr. or whoever, you know, among the cast of characters is, that is going to just go in there and get them all riled up and all wound up. They're going to, you know, you'll see the worst of people screaming at the press riser. And, you know, if they're, you should assume there are going to be some protesters in there. That's going to be a disaster. And then that doesn't even begin to explain what might happen outside the arena, given the fact that it's, you know, a day after Juneteenth, which was, you know, the day that the slaves were emancipated. And, you know, we're on the 99th anniversary of the worst race massacre in American history. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's like that hot time summer in the city. It's a bad confluence of events. And it would really take someone like Donald Trump to make sure all that stuff happened, regardless of Brad Parscale's claimed or feigned ignorance as to what he was doing and where he was doing it.
And yet, this seems to be the thing he's been waiting to do. The fact that he hasn't had a rally in 3 months and seems to be, Reed, I think you sent around an article yesterday, a New York Times article, about how uninterested the president seems to be in actually doing the job of the office, and how this is the thing he's been looking forward to. What are Republican voters to make of the president's complete lack of interest in actually doing his job, but actually he just wants to get out there and sow division at rallies? But then also, is there a picture after this event of failure? Can this rally fail for the president?
look, I think it fails for the president if 3 weeks later we have a gigantic spike in COVID cases. And, you know, what could go wrong packing 19,000 people who don't wear masks as a sign of their masculinity into a narrow, hot, crowded arena? I think the long-term down note could be, you know, this becomes an epidemiological rally. But I think the short-term down note could be, you know, flat-out conflict in the streets outside of the arena. I mean, he'll declare it a victory no matter what he does.
Well, and electorally, we've seen, you know, in surveys, and we've heard anecdotally that the president's actions and words on both the George Floyd killing and the protests in the streets, and, you know, specifically the race baiting language, has been absolutely repellent to suburban white voters, mm-hmm. in those places, mm-hmm. like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, where he won by the narrowest of margins before. And frankly, you know, those are the same types of folks that we're talking to on a daily basis. We know they probably didn't like him to begin with, right? Because he's a clown and he's a boor. But now, you know, after 3.5 years of all of this, you know, they never liked the tweets. They never really liked his language. But now in the midst of, you know, COVID, unemployment, and, you know, unrest in the streets, you know, he's totally, as Steve has said many times, far more eloquently than I, completely unfit for the job. And so I think that the uglier he gets, the more that those people sort of back away from him. And I think at some point there's like those like spikes when you return your rental car, right? Like they're going to back over those things and they're not coming back to him.
And I think, like, psychologically, you know, he's failing the country, all the consequences that we talked about. But he's failing politically. He's losing badly to Joe Biden, and he'll have a list of people that he'll blame. He's incapable of taking responsibility for everything. And so, having been cooped up for a couple months, he's probably thinking to himself, well, I'll be there. I'll connect with my people. They need to hear from me. Only I can win it. I alone can do it. So I think you'll see a performance that's just completely unhinged. You know, Trump will be more Trumpy than he's ever been. And it's going to be a vile, toxic, disgusting affair at a time of real division, real decline in the country. He's under pressure. He's panicky. And I think when you look at Donald Trump under pressure, he doesn't perform very well. He's falling apart physically. He's falling apart mentally. He's having difficulty delivering speeches that are coherent. And I think we'll see all that on display. We'll see his infirmities. We'll see his lack of capacity. All of his deficits will be on full display at a moral level, at a mental level, at an intellectual level, as he's up on that stage. And you know, I think one of the things that there's this debate that takes place in the media that, well, are we going to show the president's rally or not? Right? Should it be broadcast? And I really disagree with the idea that it should somehow be hidden from view. You know, this is real life. There's no trigger warnings. Donald Trump is the president of the United States. He won that election very, very narrowly. We're about 150 days out. And this guy's the president of the United States. He's the most powerful person in the world. And he has mismanaged this crisis that we're in so profoundly, so terribly, that the consequences of it are something that we should all stare at and contemplate every day until election day, when the American people can get this guy out of there and put a decent man into the Oval Office.
Look, the president does not hide his intentions, and he hasn't at any point. And he would sacrifice and has tried to American national security, our allies' national security, the lives of and the dreams of Americans and people seeking freedom around the world. And of course, he's going to sacrifice people for his narcissistic needing rallies. And so we're going to see, there's no way of avoiding it. He's a clone of George Wallace and Typhoid Mary when it comes to COVID. And he's going to go into these cities and communities, and there's going to be a huge spike in COVID, a huge spike in madness, a huge spike in hate and division. And like Steve said, the American people need to see this, need to see it during this summer as they're starting to determine, for those on the fence, who to vote for, a good and decent man in Joe Biden who will unite the country and start cleaning up the massive nuclear waste on aisle 6 here, or this insane, narcissistic, Sybil-like man who's in the White House.
I think in 2016, I mean, I used to make the case in 2016 during the primary that, you know, you've got to, that Trump was getting this unfair advantage by, you know, the media darkened the sky with every Trump rally. I talked to another campaign one time where they said, you know, we had this huge plan we were going to roll out. We had a press conference set up and, you know, we worked for weeks to get this thing put together. And then they cut to CNN cut away to Trump's plane circling the runway. And so that I used to say that was a huge, you know, advantage for Trump. I think now with all of his physical and cognitive deficits, all of the tensions of this impending campaign bearing down on him, and the knowledge that he can't bullshit his way out of this one. You've got, another million jobs on the unemployment rolls just reported this on Thursday. I mean, we've got surges of COVID all over the country. We've got North Korea getting feisty again. Remember that Nobel Prize he was going to get? And so I think all these pressures, you know, I want to see this because we're seeing the portrait of Dorian Gray now. We're seeing the ugly, broken down, terrifying reality of who he is.
Well, I mean, if you think about this, I mean, you know, I mean, all re-elections are a referendum on the incumbent, especially presidential elections. And I just think about the resources of the federal government at the disposal of a sitting president and why they are always so advantageous to the person sitting behind the resolute desk in such an uphill climb to the challenger. And I think it really speaks to the idea that, you know, they can't even like, among, I don't know, there's probably like seven people left in the West Wing. I literally don't know how many people work there, but it's probably not very many. They can't even come up with like what they want to do in a second term. Like this does not have to be like a detailed plan. It has to be rebuild the economy, right? Less people die, bring the country together. Like if they just said those things, he'd probably be better, but he can't do it or he won't do it. I'm not entirely... You know, I'm certainly no psychiatrist or psychologist, but the idea that, you know, even the basic blocking and tackling of the campaign is so sidelined because he can't keep it together for more than 15 minutes at a time. And I think that, you know, we're now seeing that, you know, he wakes up probably sometime at 10:30, 11 in the morning, right? I don't know what he does, you know, he watches reruns of something. And then he sort of bounds around the White House all day, you know, making people crazy. And then by 8 o'clock, he's back up in the residence watching Fox. I mean, you know, he's like a 74-year-old angry guy who screams at his television. The problem is that he's leader of the free world.
On Wednesday, the Wall Street Journal published an excerpt from Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton's upcoming book, in which Bolton claims Trump asked Chinese President Xi Jinping to help Trump win re-election. And the Lincoln Project just rolled out a new ad about Trump rolling over for China. And Reed is going to unpack this for us a little bit.
Yes. First, I think from my perspective, I think sometimes all of us, you know, and everybody, I'm not just talking about myself, you know, think of things too much in sort of, you know, binary terms. Like Donald Trump can be a bad president and John Bolton can be a bad guy and John Bolton can still be telling the truth, right? So like, I don't think John Bolton's any kind of hero. But that said, I think he's been known for taking sort of copious notes during the course of meetings. And so this book, you know, I'm not going to buy it, but I'm sure lots of reporters will. They're going to let us know all these things. And so, you know, this is like Ukraine part two, or maybe Russia part three. I don't know which chapter in can a foreign authoritarian leader help me with a domestic political errand? It's like he knows no one at home is going to help him. And he thinks that these folks, you know, whether or not it's Xi or Putin or whoever it is, are going to help him out. And it's just one more, you know, I think indication of how far the office of the presidency has fallen under Donald Trump. But, you know, the idea that it's not just, can you help me with this? That, you know, it's, you know, Xi talks about building, you know, concentration camps and Trump's like, all right, it sounds like a pretty good idea. These are things that are just anathema, not only to the presidency, but I think also to American political tradition. And I think it shows you just how quickly these things can erode if the American people don't sort of stand up and say, we're not going to put up with this anymore. And so I think it sort of redoubles for me the idea of, you know, come November 3rd and then ultimately January 20th when Biden takes the oath of office, you know, that there are real life and tangible consequences for not participating or for making bad political decisions.
So here's my question. Steve, maybe you can speak to this a little bit. How damaging are these revelations versus how damaging should they be? Considering that we have a Congress that didn't even call Bolton to testify when all of this would have been relevant.
Well, it matters in the context of the accumulation of knowledge about Donald Trump that the American people possess. And so right now, today, as we're in the middle of June, we have 100 plus thousand dead Americans. The coronavirus death rate is rising in 23 states. The president is saying that it's going away. It's just not true, right? So we are in the middle of a season of death in this country. We have, because of the mishandling of this pandemic, we have 40 million Americans out of work. It's an extraordinary number. And the idea that the economy is going to come surging back is just another Trump lie. We have long-term issues, and it will take years to recover from the economic damage, and a lot of Americans' life savings are going to be wiped out. We have seen Donald Trump undermine our alliances all over the world, most recently with the withdrawal of troops from Germany. And so our allies, the liberal democracies of the world, the value systems that are represented by those countries and their people stand in stark contrast to the Chinese system, which is a brutal one, from forced sterilizations and abortions and political repression and concentration camps. Donald Trump has been rolled by the Chinese since the earliest hours of his presidency. The most momentous decision affecting the future of the country that Donald Trump may have made during this presidency is the withdrawal of the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which ceded to the Chinese the future of the Pacific. And the United States has always been a Pacific power. And so when we look at China's ambitions to be the world's number one military power, to be the world's number one economy, to be the world's number one nation that sets the rules of the road, that has the world running under a Chinese system as opposed to an American values-led one, this is an enormous moment. And the American people should care about it and have traditionally cared about a president exhibiting weakness, subordinating the national interest, and doing things that make the world a more dangerous place. The management of the relationship with China, as Henry Kissinger would have attested, or President George Bush 41, or Richard Nixon, will be the most important thing that an American president and American diplomats do over the next 50 years. Conflict is not inevitable between our countries, but the relationship and the weakness that Trump exhibits makes the world so much more dangerous and makes the possibility of conflict between the United States and China much higher than it would otherwise be. But it's just another chapter of Trump's complete and total incompetence and incapacity to do the job of President of the United States. And not to mention the profound moral failure of President of the United States excusing Chinese concentration camps and saying it's okay. What an affront to American values and to the character and dignity of the men who have preceded him in the highest office in the land.
Well, and not only does he not care about those issues, Steve, and he doesn't understand the value of freedom seeking people in Hong Kong or dealing with the concentration camps, he's deeply conflicted. We have a president of the United States that owes the Bank of China $250 million. And there's some question as to whether or not he can pay that back. We have a president whose daughter receives secret patents routinely that takes other companies years to achieve routinely for her Chinese-made products. Just on the face of those conflicts, you have serious questions, much less getting into the fact that he has no value system or understanding of the American push for freedom and democracy and the power that our alliance in the Pacific would have been, stretching from Canada all the way to Australia, dealing with an aggressive Chinese government.
I mean, and Steve and I were talking yesterday, and Steve had this expression that we're in a time of immense chaos right now, both in the country and around the world. And we saw this, the Chinese play a long game. They understood, where the United States was in its, sort of paralysis. They understand where Trump is and what he won't do. They swooped into Hong Kong. Right now, as I think somebody mentioned, we see North Korea, right? I mean, in the Chinese, the North Koreans typically won't move without the Chinese. At any point, the Chinese could decide to make three or four power plays in the next several months, and Trump would be not only unable to do anything about it, but probably unwilling to do anything about it. And, those actions that might take days or weeks would change the balance of power and how things work, in the Pacific Rim for, as Steve said, decades to come. And so I think it is one of those things when, the United States, as Trump says, turns, America first, that doesn't mean that you need to deploy troops everywhere in the world all the time. But that does mean that, America's longstanding ability and willingness to project power, to protect the rest of the country, the countries around the world, sea lanes, trade routes, whatever it is, folks stop relying on us. And they're going to go someplace where they feel like they can get support and the help they need when they need it.
I think that's right. And I think what we pointed out in the ad yesterday, which will be in the show notes, a link to the new China ad, is that every single time Trump has gone out and bragged, "Oh, I've got China paying. They're paying huge tariffs." They're not. He's lied about it every time. And the damage he's done here at home to American farms and small businesses and to American exporters is one of the reasons why he's gotten himself on some shaky ground in states like Iowa and Wisconsin and in other places where the agriculture industry has been hit by these tariffs. And this last minute deal, he says, I agree that make the Chinese buy more soybeans. Well, he really didn't. What he did was make other concessions in the thing, and the Chinese bought what they were buying before, but still at a reduced level. So the evidence of this is so abundantly clear. And I do think the most shocking revelation so far out of the Bolton book is that Trump, and we say it in the ad, he asked President Xi like a dog to help in his reelection. He was, as read Russia Part 3, this is one more time where Trump's essentially saying, here's the quid pro quo. I want you to do me a favor first. But this time it's not to some Ukrainians, it's to the rising superpower in the world and our primary economic competitor in the world. I like the fact that we got him pretty much dead to rights without the Bolton book. And folks in the ad making process, we ended up getting that information right before the ad's release and put it in because it is a powerful argument. Donald Trump will go to anybody in the world, whether they're friend or enemy, and ask for help on the domestic political side. It is a truly remarkable sign of his low character.
So let's move to COVID, because as Trump focuses on returning to normal campaigning and reopening the economy, we're seeing coronavirus cases on the rise, not only in Oklahoma, but in 20 states and Puerto Rico. And Steve, you talked a bit about this already. Will a national reopening or stronger economic numbers help Trump in November?
We're not going to have any of that. I mean, between the fact that many of the MAGA governors, ranging from Florida to through the Deep South and to Texas and up into the Plain States, never did the right thing, never followed through. We're seeing spikes in June. We're going to see spikes in July. So this dip that the health officials were hoping for that would occur through the course of the summer, so that we would have a smaller second wave in the fall, is not going to occur. And the economy will suffer for it. But more importantly, lives are going to be lost and dreams are going to be dashed and families are going to be forever shattered because one president, one man, either through malfeasance or narcissism or ignorance or laziness or what have you, chose not to do the right thing because of his own needs. And as Reed pointed out, he's surrounded by the lowest level of low travelers in the history of American politics. And then you have these sycophant governors who, for whatever reason, refuse to do the right thing. So we're going to have, by the time we get to August, we could easily have 150,000, 170,000 deaths going into election day, well over 200,000 people dead. You know, think about during the Vietnam War, everyone in the country knew someone or some family or some group of people who were touched by the deaths of young men in Vietnam. We could have triple that, four times that by the time we get.
It's like 1 degree of separation now.
And this is all at Donald Trump's footsteps.
John, don't you think some of this is because guys like DeSantis and Abbott, they've all got their eye on 2024 now.
No, of course.
The Trump brand happy, and they want to keep Trump on their side. They don't want the mean tweet. I mean, that to me is what's almost the most disappointing and heartbreaking thing about this is it seems like a lot of this is just because they want to run for president. And that's a shitty reason to kill a meaningful number of your citizens.
To watch the president of the United States, when the numbers are going up, telling the American people that it's going away, pretending that it's under control when it's just the opposite in reality. And so the country failed collectively in the mission to flatten the curve. And so you have some people on TV talking about second wave. This isn't the second wave. This is the first wave. And the second wave of this could be much worse than the first wave. And it's out of control. There's been so much misinformation and confusion. You have somebody up there talking to the American people about taking drugs that could kill them, about injecting bleach and household disinfectants. It's beyond a farce. It's a tragedy, but it's a slow motion train wreck, you know, that's going to continue to affect people. And by the time we get to the end of this, I think John pointed out correctly, everybody, unfortunately, I think, is going to know somebody who's dead of this. And that's just a reality as the numbers keep climbing and climbing and climbing higher. But there has never been mismanagement like this ever by a president of the United States. And the truth of the matter is, this would not have happened if Hillary Clinton was the president, if Barack Obama was the president, if George W. Bush was the president. Country was prepared to deal with this. And lastly, you know, we don't watch any foreign news in this country, unfortunately, right? So it's as if there are no other countries in the world. And Americans might look at this and say, well, this is what's going on in every country. And it's not. We are the epicenter. It is worse here than anywhere. Even countries that had a horrible time with this, Italy, for example, have gotten it under control. We don't have enough contract tracing. We don't have enough testing in this country. This has been the most bungled response to a major crisis involving mass death in the history of the country. This defines Trump's presidency for all time.
Right. And so, yeah, just because impeachment wasn't enough, you know, killing a couple hundred thousand Americans on his way out the door was something else he needed to add to it. But I think, too, it's you know, as Steve calls it, this is what you get with the reality television presidency. And they also become now the reality television governorships and the reality television mayorships, if that's a word, which is, you know, it's performance art. Right. And it's all done, you know, for the purposes of the camera and for the purposes of Fox News and for the purposes of the lowest common denominator. And the idea that, you know, look, government's first job, if it's going to be legitimate, is to protect its citizens. And if it can't or won't or refuses to do so, then it is by definition, you know, not doing the work it's supposed to do, because we all go into these things with the collective agreement that we'll do this because it's better to do it together than to do it separately. And what the president is saying and what Greg Abbott is saying in Texas and Stitt is saying in Oklahoma and Kemp in Georgia and DeSantis in Florida is you're on your own. Oh, and if somebody tries to tell you the truth, like the, I think the lady that was the epidemiologist in Florida, we're going to fire them so that they can't say it. And then God bless her, she went and did it anyway. And so I think this is a much broader thing than just, you know, when we beat Trump in November. There needs to be a reckoning. And I think we've, you know, it wasn't just, you know, with Republicans, but we've seen it too with the governor and the mayor in Minnesota and Minneapolis. You know, competence matters. We don't elect these people. We should not elect these people, I say, simply because, you know, they say those, you know, five words that you know, get your lizard brain going. Can these people do their jobs? And in many cases in this country, especially, you know, in the Trump vein, it's not only can't they do it, it's they won't do it. And I'm not sure which is worse.
And that's a key point. My least favorite vegetable has always been broccoli. And I remember during the presidency of Bush 41, when he came into the White House and he said, no broccoli in the White House. I'm not eating it. And I'm the president of the United States now. And there's nothing anyone can do about it. And Trump's the same way, but about reading. Right. And so if you go back, right, to the beginning of this, we're in this mess around coronavirus because the president of the United States refuses to read an intelligence report, can't consume information. There's been stories about the elaborate lengths the intelligence agencies have to go through to try to present information to him. He's just not interested. There's never been someone more intellectually lazy and malfeasant sitting behind that desk ever, right, in the history of the country. Think about this. He hasn't talked to Dr. Fauci in weeks. I mean, how's that possible? You're the president of the United States. 100,000 Americans plus are dead, 120,000 climbing through. This is rising in 23 states, and you haven't talked to Dr. Fauci?
You just said on Monday that if we stopped testing right now, we'd have very few cases, if any.
Right. Like, I mean, it's a statement that's so galactically stupid that it's almost unfathomable that it came out of any sentient human being's mouth, let alone the president of the United States. And this is who we have leading the country in the middle of a historic pandemic. It's incredible.
Well, and look, we just got through the anniversary of D-Day recently, and I know we've all four talked about it separately and together. We have the greatest generation who saved the world, literally, and their children, the children of the greatest generation, who are most at risk. And this president and his allies in the states are putting the people that in these last few years of their life at great risk. We should be honoring them and cherishing them and taking care of them, and we're putting them at death's door, literally, because this president can't read, won't take the steps necessary. And we should prosecute this for the remaining days of his presidency.
I completely agree.
All right, just to wrap this up, I want to get from each of you the story that you're watching going into this next week that everybody listening ought to be paying attention to. So, Rick, why don't you lead us off?
Well, look, I think Tulsa is going to be a massive story over the weekend. It's going to drive a lot of the coverage for next week. Right now, though, I'm fascinated by this rift on the Trump right that the Supreme Court in the course of this week has ruled both for LGBT rights and today, while we're recording this, they came out with a 5-4 decision saying that DACA has to stay. That the Trump administration exceeded its authority on the executive orders. So I think you're going to end up seeing, Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon and all the other people in Trump's ear driving him to do more of the sort of performance art horror that they did on the border with the kids in cages and other stunts in the last year and a half, because immigration is going to be coming. His lizard brain is always activated by, you know, can I tell the story of the caravan? And so they're going to try to say that this DACA decision is another like reason that Trump has to build the wall and do all the things he's, you know, failed to do in the first round. I just think you're going to see immigration and the Supreme Court itself pop back up. They thought Gorsuch was going to be a reliable vote. It turns out he is not.
John, what are you watching this week?
Well, I'm watching two stories. I'm watching the increase in issues involving COVID and the spike in COVID, not only here in Austin where I live, but around the country and its impact on the economy and on real people and the lack of action by the federal government and state governments. I'm watching that. And then I'm watching the campaign of Trump, the campaigns of Trump and Biden, and how they're reacting to real world situations. You have in Joe Biden talking, he's talking about unifying the country. He's talking about dealing with COVID. He's talking about things that are impacting people in real time. And the current president is talking about further division, further hate. He's going to lean into immigration for sure. I'm sure the caravans are somewhere between Guatemala and El Paso, and they'll be back soon. They always appear when he's in trouble. So I'm watching the conflicting campaigns. One's on the rise and one is on the decline, much like the president.
Reed, how about you?
June, I think, is the last of the big primary campaigns for a lot of the targeted Senate races. And so I think watching what happens in Colorado, whether or not it's John Hickenlooper or Andrew Romanoff, who's ultimately going to beat Cory Gardner. And I would say this to our listeners. If you have not seen the Cory Gardner's latest political commercial, it is not just the worst campaign ad of like this
week. God,
it might
awful.
Be the worst campaign ad of all time. And that's really saying something. So I think you're going to see that. I think that you're going to see movement in Montana. I think you're going to see these things. And all of these senators now, I think it's fascinating, especially the Republicans, have so tied themselves to Trump that they have very little, if anything, to run on their own accord, on their own record. So I think what you're going to see as we hit, get past the July 4th holiday, I'm really interested to see how a lot of these Democratic candidates who are not by far, for the most part, very progressive. I think they're mostly, center left Democrats start to really, go on the ascendance. And how does Mitch McConnell and, the folks that he has arrayed start to manage that? Because they're sort of betwixt and between. They can't leave the president, but they can't stick with him. And we all know that certainly that McConnell will ultimately save himself. So I'm interested to see how that all starts to play out.
Steve, what are you watching this week?
I'm looking at two stories. First is the two largest countries in the world by population, China and India, two nuclear armed countries, have had military exchanges with casualties at 14,000 feet. In the border frontier between those two countries. It's a dangerous situation amidst all the chaos that's happening in this country, and it's been paid very, very little attention to. But Americans should be focused on that, and we should be wary of it. And then lastly, I'm very interested to see what happens with the remainder of the baseball season. And you look at baseball as the national pastime, 40 million people out of work play ball. You know, it would be good for the country, for the owners, for the players to come to some sort of resolution for a shortened season. And it brings up a larger question. What's good for the country? And you can look at companies like Facebook that are headquartered in America, but do they act like an American company should when it's being attacked by hostile foreign powers? John Bolton was the national security advisor to the United States. He possessed all of this information, and he didn't think that he was duty-bound, obligated to share it with the Congress, with the American people. Instead, he decided to monetize it. General Marshall, after he served as defense secretary, secretary of state, chief of staff of the Army, he refused in his retirement to serve on any corporate boards because he didn't want to monetize his public service. And certainly, I don't think that's the standard that should apply to people who have served in public service today, who have a right to make a living when they're out of it. But the question that I'm looking at over the horizon, the news, will anybody in this country at a leadership level say, but it's good for America? And I think that when you look at all of this stuff, it's just a conversation that's missing from the dialogue in a way that's really unfortunate.
This episode was recorded when I hosted the Lincoln Project podcast on this feed. If you have any questions or advice, you can reach us at podcast@politicology.com. And please know that even if we don't respond, we read every email we get, and we love hearing from you. If you enjoy the show, it would help us if you could rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.